You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast series, The Psychology of Happiness, with Gregory Salmieri, Gina Gorlin, and Dave Rubin.
I am glad you guys are here. Greg, we've done a couple of these, but Gina, this is your first time in studio, so I'm going to start with you. We're doing this series, the core of it is really about happiness. So what is happiness? What does happiness mean to you?
Sure.
As you look at me and smile.
This is it, right here. So the way that I understand happiness, maybe from a more psychological angle, is a coherent and flowing way of life in which all the different parts connect to each other and in which you are making choices that align with what brings you joy, what you value, what matters to you, and you feel like it all kind of fits.
So a sort of cohesive view of the world, is that within your scope of looking at happiness?
Yeah, but I would say for happiness, it's a cohesive view and feeling of your own life, that it's going well. Because you could have a cohesive worldview on which the world sucks and it's all very coherent, but right. you're not liking it. But the feeling you have about your life when you enjoy what you're doing and all the joys in your life resonate with one another. Rand described it as a state of non-contradictory joy, and that formulation's always had a real resonance with me.
Yeah. How much of this, of the pursuit of happiness, is the actual point? That if you're just on the adventure, if you're on the path to attaining happiness, that actually is what happiness is?
Yeah, so I think both on the objectivist perspective, as I understand it, and in terms of what I try to cultivate with clients in my practice, I view happiness inherently as a process as much as it is an outcome. And in terms of how I understand, for example, so this idea of non-contradictory joy that comes from the pursuit of non-contradictory values, in a way, the pursuit is part of the definition, that the state itself is as much an activity as it is a state. Yeah. And there are concepts in psychology that really nicely fit with that idea, you know, the growth mindset and the idea that you are always actively engaging in your own life in a way that feels a certain way.
Yeah. Do you find it bizarre that it seems like so many people have cohesive worldviews that are actually what you referenced earlier, which are just making them miserable? But it's a cohesive view, which is interesting. So it's not just about assembling something. Mm-hmm. It's about assembling something, hopefully, that'll make you happy.
Yeah, I think, we need a cohesive worldview to live. We have to make decisions all the time, whether we're going to take a risk, whether we're going to not, whether we're going to play it safe, whether we're going to go by our own judgment or follow what other people say. And just in millions of different ways, you're having to make judgments that depend on having an overall sense of what the world is like and of what you're like. And if you don't work out one consciously, you know, your choices are going to add up to some take on what the world is like. So I don't think it's too surprising that everyone has one. It's sad that a lot of people's are really bleak. And I don't think they have to be. I think it comes from, largely from bad philosophy or false, what I think are false philosophical ideas that lead us to think we have less control over our lives than we do, that lead us to not step up to the plate at the moment where it's really important. And then doing that earns us a kind of better view of ourselves and better view of the world.
Yeah. Was it the pursuit of happiness that woke you guys up to objectivism? I mean, before you considered yourselves objectivists per se, was it that missing piece perhaps that led you there?
It's a good question. Actually, if anything, the way I would have held it at the time, it was much more the quest for an ideal, for some kind of spiritual grandeur and meaning and purpose in life. Mm-hmm. And I had the conviction at the time, I was a teenager going through one of my angsty phases in high school and trying to figure out, you know, do I just let myself be this nerdy, geeky, intellectual kid who gets made fun of and has no friends and is lonely, but at least is really living up to some sort of higher tragic ideal,
or Lisa Simpson,
sure, I could think of any number of actual or ironic examples. But on the other hand, there was the choice to be ditzy and lighthearted and wear Abercrombie and Fitch and have a gay old time, the way that the kids in my cohort construed what it meant to be happy. And I thought I had to choose. And I was really engaged in this dramatic internal conflict, all of which is cataloged in my journals of the time.
Yeah.
And when I read The Fountainhead was the big one for me, the revelation was that you don't necessarily have to choose, that there is a kind of life and a kind of spiritual outlook that both promotes happiness, but also reconstrues what it means to be happy in a way that's a lot more noble and aspirational and idealistic.
Yeah. What about for you?
I had something similar in a way. I mean, when I was very young, I thought of myself, like, you know, a child, I thought of myself as happy, and I really enjoyed life, and I enjoyed who I was. And as I was getting, the more I came to growing up into teenage years and thinking about what am I going to do when I am an adult and get out into the world, the more it seemed like there's not a place in the world for me. And the people who I saw who were adults, none of them, I mean, some of them were nice and good, but none of them had lives that they were really thrilled with and loved, or that I think maybe they did that I would have been thrilled with and loved. And the people who I liked most were people who had something they were really interested in, something they were really about. When you went to their house, you'd talk about this. You know, this guy did woodworking, this relative, and this one was a musician. But for all of them, it was a kind of hobby they did on the weekends. And I had some things like that. I was into guitar. I don't know how good I was, but I was playing guitar a lot and things like that. And I loved doing that. But I knew it wasn't something I was going to make a career of or even wanted to make a career of. But none of the things it seemed like I could make a career of, none of the paths I saw forward seemed like things that I would really love and really like. And it felt like you can just have these hobbies in your life and then you have to do something normal or ordinary. And it just felt so unspecial, so I had this sense that life could be something really interesting and profound. There's something good about me that I want to nurture, and I don't see anyone doing it. And at a certain point, I had read a little bit of Rand when I was younger and on a politics kick. Even I was pretty precocious in junior high, but I hadn't been thinking about her at this time. And at some point, I started just taking control of myself. I was in my first year of college, and I was thinking, this is no good. I'm on this track. Everyone around me seems to be on a track. It's like that 60s song. They put you in little boxes and you come out all the same as doctors and lawyers. To hell with this. I'm going to figure out what I like about myself and where I can find it in the world. And I was going to some philosophy club meetings and I thought, I'm really good at this. I like this. I don't know how I can make a life out of this, but let me double down on this. And it was at that time, as I started studying philosophy more, that, you know, I had read one book of Rand's time ago, but one of my professors was actually had been a friend of Ayn Rand's. And at that point, I started reading Ayn Rand's novels and some of her nonfiction too again. And there was this vision of these people who felt about their lives the way I felt about mine and felt about what they wanted to do in life as I felt about mine. And I had had this idea that the things that were special about me, my mind, my really wanting to know the truth, my trying to get to the deepest causes of things, they were like some evolutionary tendril, something that developed by accident in people, but had no place in the world of earning a living and keeping yourself alive. And what I really learned from Rand, especially from Atlas Shrugged, was the idea that, no, that thing about you, your mind, your reason, understanding causes, that is productive. That's what keeps human beings alive. And if you're not finding a way to do it, to make using your mind in the way that's what you love and the way that's kind of the most intense use of it you can do, if you're not finding a way to make that your life and to make that remunerative, you're not looking hard enough.
Yeah, it's interesting. You hit a lot of things there, obviously. But, you know, for me, I sit across all these brilliant people all the time. And every week I meet some new thinker or author or someone that's really doing something. And everyone that I can't say about this about everyone I've interviewed, but the people that I'm most struck by are the ones who are sort of on a mission, that they've done something in their life, that there's a mission. Every day I wake up, I am on a mission. I don't have 2 seconds to think about anything else beyond the mission. I should probably work on that perhaps, so that's a different show. But so is that really it? It's that you've got to find what your mission is.
I think that's a really big part of it. And I think that's true. I have a similar observation, and it was largely what inspired me to join this community and explore these ideas to begin with, was just seeing the kind of passion and energy and self-sustaining joy in life that comes from, you know, these people who really, they're missionaries. They're fighting a battle of ideas, or they're trying to put some new discovery, you know, on the map, or, you know, they have an idea for a new kind of phone that is a microcomputer, and they are so passionate about trying to figure out what their user, you know, their end user is really going to want and to like playing with, that mm-hmm. they're ready to put themselves on the line and, you know, to be fired from their own company. And then, obviously, you know, I have Steve Jobs in my head.
Yeah.
But just as a kind of example of someone who is really, like, he's living. You know, it's like every day really, there's something holy about it.
Yeah.
You know, in a way that I assume people try to capture in their religious
ecstasy. Is
there a
risk in that, though? That it would become so obsessive that actually happiness then sort of takes a back seat to just the thing itself?
Yeah, so I think to the extent that you don't really attend to the different dimensions of your life, including the relationship domain and the kind of recreation and family and the aspects of your life that in part are the point of pursuing the mission, you know, that there's this reciprocal creation of value and enjoyment of whatever, whether it's, you know, the financial gains or whether it's just the pride and the, you know, excitement of having achieved something new that you can then go and enjoy, you know, with your friends, with your family, and the kind of dynamic integration of parts that we were talking about that I think makes a life whole and that keeps us interested and kind of allows us to fully savor mm-hmm. the whatever it is that we're working so hard to create, then I think there's always that risk of a kind of loss of context, you know, or a kind of single-minded purpose that doesn't fully take into account the full
scope of one's life. Yeah, and yet perhaps maybe you need a little bit of that to be the game changer, you know what I mean?
I think having a perspective on that being on a mission, and the mission being not a mission for someone else, but something you love doing. Mm-hmm. To have the idea that that's moral and that's good and that's central to a moral life, if you don't have that idea, then you're going to necessarily be in conflict with how is this going to relate to my family? How is it going to relate to what my parents want of me? How is it going to relate to having a relationship? Knowing that that thing is good mm-hmm. and that it's a central component of a good life doesn't make all those issues of budgeting your time and so forth go away. You still only have so many hours in the day. But it, I think, makes it a kind of tractable, manageable, normal conflict about just how you devote your time, rather than having parts of yourself that are warring with one another.
Yeah.
Should I be the good husband or the good creator?
You know? Well, what's the best way to get someone to that place where they can understand that doing for yourself is sort of the first step in leading the rest of a complete life?
In a way, Gina is someone who works with people as a therapist, so you might have more...
I guess that's a part of my
daily
job.
Well, let's shift this to the psychological part of this then.
Sure,
What is that first step? If you were with somebody that really is sort of in chaos, let's say, as Jordan Peterson would say, what's the first step to getting them to realize that you got to take your life seriously? That might help to start.
Yeah, so I guess it depends on where the chaos is coming from, but I would say that one of the first steps for me with almost every client that I work with is to do some form of values clarification exercise. So to really get explicit and clear about what are all the different competing pulls in their life, and to zoom out a little bit and imagine their 100th birthday. Some people do the funeral exercise, but I prefer, you know, that's a bit morbid.
Yeah.
So we just go, you're alive and you're 100 and you're, you know, reflecting back on your life.
The funeral one would be a bit morbid.
Right, exactly. So it's hence the, I prefer, the birthday one. But when you're reflecting back on your life, you're writing your autobiography or you're listening to people, you know, your family and your friends and your colleagues give toasts at your 100th birthday life celebration, what would you most like to hear? And what would it look like if you had lived out the remaining, you know, whatever, how old they are now, you know, 50, 60 years of your life in the way that would truly mean the most to you and really fulfill you? And then whatever it is that they say at a first, you know, to kind of use that as clues to, first of all, you know, where are the contradictions? So to what extent are you kind of torn between, on the one hand, well, I guess I would want to have been creative and to have taken risks and maybe done something kind of new or learned new, but on the other hand, I would have wanted to be there for my family. And to the extent that there's a perceived conflict there, or that they might even be scared to kind of flesh out the creative path and what that might look like, then I might really look at that with them soberly and really try to, okay, wait, so to the extent that your family doesn't want you to pursue your dream or to, you know, to actually take the chance and, you know, leave law school and go to film school or do the thing you're really excited about, who's actually winning in that? I mean, do you want to have the kind of relationship where you're always resenting them for having, you know, basically stifled you in your pursuit of your dreams? And are you sure that that's even what they want for you? I mean, would they enjoy having this sad, washed up, you know, kid who didn't amount to much and is idling around but always saying their prayers or always doing,
and
you know,
their
chores?
And even if they didn't want that kid, that's not the reason to give them that kid, right?
Right, because then...
That would actually be the exact reason not to give them that kid.
Precisely.
Yeah. It's interesting to me that you said perceived conflict, because I do think a lot of people are sort of stuck. I think we've all had moments of this in life where it's perceived that if you do this, some horrible thing is going to happen, or if you just don't do anything, you'll be okay, but any other move...
If you dare to live in any way.
What does that tell you about the psychological condition, that it's a perception problem at some level?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the key elements of the kind of therapy and the kind of psychological coaching that I do, is to recognize that we have beliefs whether we know we have them or not, and sometimes the implicit ones are the ones doing the most damage to the extent that we haven't really checked whether they make sense. You know, so lots of people certainly come into therapy with me with all kinds of catastrophic predictions about what will happen if I take the subway, in some cases, or get on a plane, but more often what will happen if I defy my family's wishes or defy society's wishes and take this risky, bold move? Isn't everyone, am I going to be a pariah? Will everybody hate me? Will I ever find anybody who actually understands and is like-minded? And then we work with those beliefs or those expectations and actually collect evidence, often by putting the hypothesis to the test. We say, well, let's see, let's just take a tiny little baby step in the direction of standing up to mom, you know, or whatever the case may be, and just to see how it goes. Yeah. Kind of setting up behavioral experiments is actually what we call them. And then slowly, to the extent that you find corrective evidence that, which is quite often what happens, I thought mom would disown me and would never forgive me, but actually she was kind of grumpy for a day and then she came to terms with it, or, you know, anything in between.
Yeah.
But usually whatever actually happens turns out to be more manageable than whatever their imagination was able to cook up as a disaster scenario. And so putting those perceptions to the test is a big part of the treatment and the application of these ideas.
Yeah,
that's worked for me.
At a philosophical level, do we seem to be at a strange time in humanity, maybe because of our phones and the distractions and the endless onslaught of information and how much faster it's all getting and all of these things, where there seems to be a mass amount of people who spend a tremendous amount of time doing everything but doing what we're talking about here?
You know, it's really hard to tell, because there's that thing that goes around on YouTube, not on YouTube, on Facebook sometimes, of one of these clips about people with their heads in their smartphones, and it's put over a picture of everybody on a subway with their heads in the newspaper.
So they're juxtaposing that we've always been doing this sort of thing.
Always something, and it changes what thing it is. And at times when the changes are happening, it's a little harder to, you know, have adaptive, well-worked-out habits for dealing with it. But, I mean, the way I think of the philosophy and the psychology relating is that philosophy asks these kinds of questions that are applicable to everyone and every time. And psychology gives you the kind of, it's one of the special sciences, and its job is to work out the details for how to achieve mental health in your own case and how to achieve happiness. And the way I think about some of the things Gina was talking about the cognitive behavioral therapy techniques she uses in her practice and how it relates to philosophy is getting the sense of reality testing your beliefs, of wanting to make sure your goals are consistent, and of having something that your life is about for you, and then having the other elements of your life integrated around that. These are things I think we should all learn as we grow up, that we should see as part of a healthy maturation process, and that we should recognize as morally good. And I think that the role of morality in our lives ought to be to instill this kind of practice in us. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean that it'll give you all the advice you need to do it, but if we were as a culture on the premise of this is what it is to be a good person, this is what's good about you, then we would be thinking about how to, all of us, how to do it better, how to raise our kids to do it better, how to educate them to do it better. We'd be on this life design premise all growing up. And since we're not as a culture on that premise, we think, you know, that's good or that's fine, but that's not what makes you a good person. That's not what morality is about. Morality is about sacrifice and doing for others and so forth. Mm-hmm. And all this stuff is irrelevant to it. That it's only in the areas that we as a society see as remedial, or this guy's suffering and he screwed up, so now we're going to fix him, that we get people attending to what techniques will help you get your life back on track, find purpose in your life. Mm-hmm. And so in psychotherapy, I think we have some techniques that, I mean, this is not my specialty, but seem like they're really
oriented towards
improving
toward
life. And
philosophy, as we think of it. Yeah,
and philosophy's role is to say why that's good and why we all need that. And that's just one version of a technology to do it.
So is one of the interesting pieces here that we just don't talk about morality in a sort of cohesive way without talking about religion, where you guys obviously mm-hmm. would want to talk about it outside of a religious framework. There's really no discussion in the public sphere. There's a little bit. There is some now, actually. You know, these debates that Sam Harris has had mm-hmm. with Jordan Peterson that we've talked about before. There is some debate about it and where ethics come from and the Enlightenment and things like that. But that we don't do a good conversation mm-hmm. about morality.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that was one of the biggest draws for me, because I mentioned I was searching for meaning and I was hungry for a purpose and for some way to connect together all these different things I was thinking about as a teenager trying to make sense of the world. And what this perspective armed me with was a set of ideals, a set of principles, a set of ambitious moral guidelines that also connect to the things I spend my day doing and thinking about, that I was able to actually connect up causally. You know, why is it that I ought to have self-discipline and think long-term and try to actually be honest in situations where it's really difficult and have the really hard conversations and not always take the easy way out? Oh, because those are things that are going to actually be necessary to build a life mm-hmm. where I can experience meaningful joy on a daily basis, because that's how I'll build relationships that will really fulfill me and stimulate and challenge me. Because if you lie to people, they're not going to trust you as much. And if you lie to yourself, then you're going to end up acting in ways that undermine your own long-term interests. So to be able to actually connect sort of the moral fervor that I think comes from like a moral code, and typically that people get from religion or from some slightly secularized version of religion, but that keeps a lot of the content, mm-hmm. that instead that same moral fervor actually gets channeled into what I think is its proper pursuit, which is to guide you in living. And that's much more motivating somehow than, you know, to not have God mad at you or to not be bad.
Right. So why is it so hard to sell these ideas? Well, you know, there's a tremendous amount of pushback, obviously, mm-hmm. against Rand, generally speaking, where a lot of what you're saying, I think, seems self-evident to most people. The idea that you've got, it's on you to get your life going. I mean, that's sort of the essence of what we're talking about here. Why is there such pushback on that?
Well, there are a number of reasons, but one of them is the morality we're taught to judge ourselves by. And our self-esteem, which is like a crucial need and part of life, to think you're a good person and know you're a good person, the standards by which we judge ourselves by are tied up in the morality we're raised in. And a lot of the morality people are raised with is religious. If it's not religious, it's, you call it like a secularized version of religion. Mm-hmm. And there's it's a morality that's about like putting up a big stop sign and saying, don't do this. Here are the things, thou shalt not this, thou shalt not that. And some of the things it says thou shalt not do, you shouldn't do. But, you know.
But not for the reasons,
yeah,
or lack of reasons.
Yeah, when you don't kill someone and steal, there's a lot of time left in the day that it's not giving you advice on.
right.
So, and it's summed up as what thou shalt really not do is live for yourself. What's good about you is what you do for others, and in particular, how much you give up. How much you give up for others. And if you're brought up with that in one way or another, and that's just a big part of your thinking from childhood, and it's reinforced by so many things in the culture. There are other things in the culture that push in the other way, but so much of it reinforces what makes you good or admirable or noble is that you suffer, that you sacrifice, that you give up, that you do for someone other than or larger than yourself, whether it's God or the community. Then it feels wrong, bad, dangerous, selfish,
as it were,
to say, no, my life is what matters. My life is what matters to me. That's my priority. And when somebody says that, and particularly when they say it and advocate radical political views that go along with what that means if you really understand it, the kind of freedom it requires, mm-hmm. that it's horrible if people are suffering through no fault of their own, but that doesn't make the business of your life to fix it at your own expense. It's scary. It runs against the grain, and it's, I mean, Rand described herself as challenging 2,000 years of moral thought, and our moral thought's just a big part of who we are. It's dangerous and scary to challenge it.
Yeah. Yeah. And one of the main psychological costs of that, in my experience, is a lot of guilt, and Rand distinguished between earned and unearned guilt, and a lot of the pushback that I find, especially in people who maybe have been exposed to the ideas and are grappling with them, or haven't explicitly been exposed to them but are facing some sort of conflict between, you know, pursuing their passion at the cost of upsetting their family members, mm-hmm. or, you know, that, oh, well, but I'm going to be making money and that's bad somehow and I should instead, you know, do some sort of nobler thing. That there's such a mass of confusion in their minds between the kind of guilt that I call interjected, that's kind of coming from some external standard, external authority that they drank in with their mother's milk, mm-hmm. that doesn't really necessarily reflect what they want and ultimately, you know, what kind of cause-effect relationships in the world they're trying to affect, but rather is just this kind of stodgy leftover standard, versus the kind of guilt that actually comes from not pursuing your passion and from giving up on some of your values and your goals and giving up on, you know, aspects of yourself. And it all kind of gets mashed together in a way that is really confusing for people to work through. And so a big part of my work, and I think of the advocacy, you know, to the extent that we're trying to expose people to the value of the ideas, is to really separate out a lot of those kind of packages that come from, okay, but say, you know, but what you're saying is I should be selfish, but when I'm selfish, I'm an asshole, mm-hmm. because those are kind of the alternatives that have been presented to me. And it's between being an asshole and neglecting my family and my friends and, you know, just going off on this obsessive path versus giving up on my professional passion or whatever and just being nice and doing, you know, whatever, a mission trip.
Yeah. So basically, there's a difference between, say, being a narcissist and having rational self-interest. I mean, that would basically
boil down. Yeah, I'd say those are very different things.
Yeah. Indeed. And yet, you know, some people are seemingly caught in between those things.
Also, I think something Gina mentioned earlier about having a causal perspective, I think is really significant here, and significant to what people think of as morality and why they don't see what Rand is offering as a morality at first when they encounter it. If you are on this duty-based premise where what morality is something that constrains your self-interest rather than helps you define and enable it, then morality is a kind of enemy to yourself. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you are always worried about how to stay within its bounds, and you're always, it instills in someone a kind of almost in its way narcissistic focus on one's own character
yeah.
that comes with this kind of guilt. Am I good enough? Did I do the wrong thing? Was it okay that I did that? I'm sorry, did I offend you? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to. And this kind of internal focus on am I good enough? Kant, for example, is talking about, you know, what actions give you true moral worth and do you have it? And you're kind of focusing on do I have moral worth? Am I worthy? Was I good? Did I do the right thing?
It makes you very self-focused. And
it's a destructive self-doubt kind of focus.
But what's interesting, though, is that a lot of people would say, well, wait a minute, if you're putting this all on your own mind, then that's the most self-focused you can possibly be.
But if what you're putting on your own mind is, I want to use my mind to find a way to lead a life that I can love and that I do love and that supports me and sustains me in getting more and more of what I love, then you're focused outward at that point on reality. Well, what are the causes I need to enact to affect the results I want? If I want this kind of job, how do I go get it? If I want to have better relationships with people because I see what those relationships will bring to my life, how do I do it? What are the causes I need to get the effects I want in life? And so morality and the kind of thinking you do about your life becomes causal, not focused on grading yourself, but focused on what does it take to achieve what I need, what I want to get out of life, and then whatever kind of self-grading or self-evaluation you need to help you do that better. Mm-hmm. I've recognized that being honest is important, and yet I wasn't fully honest with so-and-so the other day, so I've got to work on that. But it's focused on because this is going to get me something. Mm-hmm. This is going to achieve what I want out of life. And there's this causal focus. Rand spoke of people being disciples of causality.
Mm-hmm.
And
versus
I think that's a really...
Versus disciples of duty.
Versus disciples of duty, yeah.
So when the founders put the phrase, the pursuit of happiness in the Declaration of Independence, that's basically as good as it gets, right? I mean, that they're not giving it to you. We can't guarantee you happiness with this document. We can't just hand it to you. But we can at least give you a society that's free enough to allow you to pursue some of that stuff. So at a psychological level,
absolutely.
They did that's a really nice gift to give a nation.
Yes, if we can keep it, right?
Yeah,
absolutely. And I would say related both to the pursuit of happiness and kind of what Greg was saying about causality, one of the ways these ideas have been powerful for me is that there's as much of an orientation toward reality, toward what's actually real, toward a genuine life you can love and not just one you can kind of pretend to love, mm-hmm. and a focus on actually making good things happen rather than trying to perceive things to be the way that would make you feel good, you know, where it's sort of reality ahead of emotions and whims and impulses, that being able to connect together, okay, so I matter, my life matters, how I spend these however many years that I have to pursue, you know, whatever ends matters, and I can't just wish things into being. Mm-hmm. You know, that the world is a certain way, that existence has primacy over consciousness is the kind of fancy technical way, you know, that she puts it, but what that actually means is, look, like, things are what they are, and you're gonna have to actually figure out how to change them if you want them to be different. That complaining about it, wishing it away, is just not gonna work. And that's not real happiness. You know, brain in a vat, like, take a pill that makes you fantasize that you're living a certain kind of life.
Right. Is it odd that we put so much emphasis on the external idea of happiness? So, like, you know, you put a picture up on Facebook, and if you get 100 likes, you're happier than if you get 2. Or you might sit there for a minute.
That's actually not true. Empirically, that's not true. People aren't happier.
Are they not? Is that empirically not true?
Perhaps in the moment, their positive affect increases for some number of minutes.
I think they figured out that there's diminishing returns, actually, and over the long term, you're less happy because you're always trying to get that dopamine hit of another like. But I mean, I can tell you that even though I'm well aware of a lot of this stuff, if I tweet something and it really catches fire, it's not that it makes me happy, but there's a sense of reward. Or if I tweet something and it doesn't get any traction, I go, you know, I'm not depressed, but I'm like, oh, did I miss the mark there?
Yeah.
Or something like that.
Well, I mean, in your case with tweeting, it's part of your career too, so it has an extra dimension to it. But there is the bigger thing, we're always chasing
the... I do post food pictures too, which have nothing to do with that.
All right, fair enough.
Yeah.
So there is are we always chasing the next little fix, you know? And I mean, a lot of times people are. The question is sort of what's the alternative to that? And the alternative to that is being real about what you want out of life and being long-term about it, to really thinking about it. And something that, I'll just give an example of a counterpoint view that really bothers me. And it goes back to the philosopher Auguste Comte, who's the guy who coined the term altruism, but you see Peter Singer and other modern proponents of altruism really pushing it nowadays. The idea that when you pursue things for yourself, you're on a kind of hedonism treadmill. You get a little fix, you accomplish the thing you wanted for yourself, like, you know, a full stomach or the taste of a sweet thing or of a wine or, you know, the feeling of an orgasm. You get that sensation and it's nice, and that's what it is to do something for yourself. But then it fades in the next minute and you gotta get the next thing or get the Joneses to look up for you. There'll be some cheap, shallow fix that you're chasing, and when you get it, it's unsatisfying because it goes away in the next moment.
Right. And yeah, that's not happiness.
It is true that a lot of people are living that way. But Singer and Comte think that the only alternative to that is to live for other people instead. That can somehow give you some long-term rewarding thing. But what that really amounts to is trying to relieve other people's suffering. So trying to get the opposite of maybe a quick fix for them, but the diminution of someone's pain in a moment. And there are always going to be people with pains. And so you're on this other kind of treadmill of running through the world trying to, like the boy with his finger in the dike, or putting a Band-Aid over every wound. And the idea that the only alternatives is that you're someone who runs around the world bandaging wounds and maybe trying to do it in the most effective way you can versus being someone who's always looking for his next hit of Coke or whatever it is or something equally shallow, I think
those
really
are some sad alternatives.
Misses out on what actually does give life meaning, which is coming up with a purpose that adds up to something.
Yeah.
And it's not what makes you happy isn't little hits of dopamine. We have dopamine in these chemicals, but what they're in our brains for is to give us a capacity to appreciate our lives. Mm-hmm. And if you order and structure your life into something you love, your career, your wife, your hobbies, but as part of a whole, you then experience those hits not as here's my next high and I need my next fix, but here's one more thing that fits into my life that's going well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's what I think life's about.
Yeah, and Greg was saying before, if I can interject a little bit, that you know we can't help the fact that we need some kind of perspective on life and that we need some kind of self-esteem. We need to feel like basically, you know, we're going about things in an okay way and that disaster isn't around every corner. And if we don't derive that kind of, if we don't find genuine self-esteem and genuine purpose in some kind of coherent and accurate, you know, worldview, then we end up with something that we get externally, whether that's from people approving of us and liking our tweets, or whether that's from following the dictates of our religion, or you know, whatever it may be, but we need it from somewhere. And so I think a big part of the reason people, I think a lot of us even who are trying, are aspiring to some kind of more idealistic standard, but who have in our heads from early on that no, self-esteem comes from other people and comes from getting their approval, that we do find ourselves emotionally kind of feeling tethered to that approval. And that's a really hard thing, but a possible habit to break.
Yeah, is that also a little bit of why spreading ideas that are based on the individual, where you don't want to exert power over other people, they're a little harder to spread because it's a little easier to tell people you can solve all their problems or that you're going to live for them or all of those things or that the government can fix all those things. But if you're tethered in the idea of you should live for yourself, the government shouldn't solve all these things, others shouldn't solve all these things, well, that's a little harder to think about. It may not just spread as virally as some of these other ideas.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth to that. And even apart from the government in particular side of it, there's the, if you're afraid, if you don't feel efficacious, there's a need or a desire to find a gang or a tribe to protect you. And then even if you do feel efficacious as a person, you don't have this psychological problem or lack in you, if you really are in a world where there are threats that abound from other people, as there is in our political system where everyone's already ganging up on everyone else to you know, exert the next favor for this group or that group, you know, should we have the law on the internet that favors Google or that favors Netflix, and or that favors your home business or my kind of business, and so forth. And when all of that is happening, or that favors blacks versus whites or women versus men, there's a justified sense that one's under attack and one has to get into the fight and get with the tribe of people who will have one's back, and you know, then fight back against the other tribes. And I think we're seeing a lot of that in there's always been a lot of that in culture and politics, but I think we're seeing a lot of it now. And to tell someone, you have to step back. The key to life is stepping back from all the tribes and all the groups. If you got to deal with one to get someone off your back, okay, but that's not, life's not about that tribal identity or that political faction. It's about deciding what you want your life to be and trying to make it, and then engaging in politics and culture where you need to protect that, as Franklin put it, the ability to, as Jefferson put it, the ability to pursue happiness, right? Our political goal is to secure that, but the wanting to secure that presupposes that we're people who want to pursue our happiness. And if you look, the reason I said Franklin instead of Jefferson, if you look at Franklin's autobiography, where he's giving his perspective on virtue and trying to develop all these virtues, and they're not just about, you know, not harming others, they're about developing to the kind of person he wants to be, you see a generation of people who are really concerned about pursuing their own happiness, and that's why they're fighting for a political system that will protect all of our ability to do that. And it's very easy to get sucked into fights about politics and lose track of what politics is for.
Yeah. Do you sense that people right now, just because the political system is so out of whack and media and everything, do you think people are actually less happy because of that?
Well, I think it's an empirical question, so I can only speculate, and I haven't sampled a representative, you know, kind of proportion of the population, but it wouldn't surprise me.
Because it doesn't seem to be giving a lot of people a lot of
it wouldn't surprise me. Well, and there are certain things we know. We know that post-Trump's election, there were various spikes in anxiety and in various, you know, mental health symptoms. There was a, like, post-Trump 15, except it was more like 20, you know, like pounds gained in the wake of the election. This is, of course, among the fairly liberal-minded college communities where these types of studies, you know, get done. But I think that it would be plausible. I wouldn't be shocked to find that there's more fear and there's kind of more animosity and less passionate, courageous kind of moving forward, given, yeah, that people feel like we're caught in this awful gridlock.
It's not just Trump was elected and then this had Trump's, and the popularity of Trump is a product of a kind of culture where we're viewing politics a certain way, and we're in the midst of an opioid epidemic. So the kinds of examples you were giving of these surveys that
already
are done where people were getting unhappy were in a largely liberal campus group, just because psychology professors do their studies on this. But if you look at where the opioid epidemic is raging, that's largely in a different population. Of course, there's overlap, and maybe in a more conservative population. So I think we're seeing a lot of signs that people are unhappy, particularly recently. Why that's coming to a head in the mid-2010s rather than in the late 1990s or the early 2000s, that's a kind of difficult question to answer. I don't know how to answer that.
Although in the late 1990s, there was a lot of grunge music, so I don't know how happy people were then. But at the most existential level, if I said to you, what is the meaning of life? The biggest question there is, would you say that it is this, that it is the pursuit of happiness?
So I would say that life is the meaning of life. And I mean, I'm not making this up. I'm at least paraphrasing a familiar kind of sentiment. But I think the quest for an external meaning is part of this dichotomy that we've been talking about, where we've been taught that we have to find the sanction and the higher purpose outside of ourselves in either some higher realm or amongst everyone else who isn't us, because somehow they have magical insight that we lack into, you know, what actually is going to make our days count the most. But I would say that as someone who has really tried my hardest to pursue a purpose that I'm passionate about and to really work toward goals that I find meaningful, I feel like I kind of know what the meaning is. It's not this constant like chasing after some further meaning. I remember when I didn't, you know, I mentioned like that's kind of where a lot of my thinking about this started, was that I was definitely unhappy and I was searching around for something to give me meaning. And the first the fictional and then the real life examples that I discovered were ones that were really self-generating of the that, wow, this is what it looks like to be a fully flourishing human. And that's what it looks like for him and for her and for her. So now what is it going to look like for me? Mm-hmm. You know, what do I already know about myself? And what are the things that make me cry? And what are the things that really, you know, that make it worthwhile for me to go days without sleep? And like, that's the meaning. Mm-hmm. So
there's a line in it's both in Atlas Shrugged and in one of Rand's essays where she talks about the three values that are the means to and realization of the ultimate value of your life and their reason, purpose, and self-esteem. And she gives a little gloss on each of them. And what she says about purpose has always stood out to me as very thought-provoking. So she says reason, you have to value reason as your tool of survival. And then purpose as your choice of the happiness that that tool will proceed to achieve. And the idea of, it's in a way the goal is happiness, but it's your choice of the happiness. And what I take that to mean isn't just that you choose happiness versus settling for something less, although that's important too, but that like your happiness is going to be different from mine, it's going to be different from Gina's, it's going to be different from the viewers. You have to choose some happiness, some life that is a life of achievement, where you're going to be able to be a process of getting values, where you know that you made the values and you see how the value adds something to the rest of your life. And there are like a million or God knows how many lives you can come up with that are like that, just like there are God knows how many melodies you could write. But you've got to pick one. You've got to write one. You've got to choose one.
And it can't just be anything, right? Because it has to have certain objective features.
It has to have a certain structure, yeah.
Yeah.
So you can't structure for it to be something that you can achieve, right? And when I think of what the meaning of life is, I think of the meaning of a life, of your life, of my life, not some kind of cosmic meaning we all have. And the meaning of the life, I think, is the happiness you choose to pursue in it. And that'll be different for each of us, but it'll have structural similarities. And I think the point of philosophy is to, or at least of my philosophy, of objectivism, Rand's philosophy, is to give you the principle by which you could see what kind of lives can be like that.
And then is self-esteem then born out of that, by making that decision and living a life that is complete? Is that then where self-esteem comes from? So you sort of need to choose that first?
So I think it goes both ways, actually, in that I think you need some preliminary conviction that you're at least capable of trying for things, you know, that at least there's the possibility that eventually you'll figure something out that is going to bring you joy, or that you know, that the effort is somehow worthwhile mm-hmm. in order to even take those steps.
So but you need like a bud of self.
Yeah, I like that. You need a bud of self-esteem. And I think that that actually is something most of us, if raised, you know, in a loving, supportive home, and if all goes well, I think the natural state of affairs is, you know, as a baby who's like learning all this new stuff every day and who's, you know, struggling to figure out how to walk and then figures it out, and it's like this tremendous achievement, you know, at that point in our little lives, and who is constantly looking outward and finding new things that are exciting and that they want more of, and, you know, developing these loving relationships with parents, and like, it's pretty natural, I think, again, unless somehow thwarted or unless you're being taught really bad things or someone's really getting in your way, it's natural to implicitly to start out from fairly early on with this kind of tacit conviction that, you know, there's stuff out there I want and I'm capable of getting it if I, you know, if I work at it. And if I make mistakes, that's okay because I can fix and learn from my mistakes, you know, and to have that perspective, at least at the level of like, learning how to build blocks, you know, or learning to ask mommy for milk. Right. And then as we grow up, it becomes, you know, the scope of our goal pursuits and the challenge, the kind of mental complexity of what it is that, you know, like figuring out, okay, if I want to be a surgeon, I need to go to med school and I need to learn all these things, but which type of surgeon, you know, it gets more complicated and there are more ways to go wrong, not just in the particular, you know, steps we take, but in how we think about ourselves and mm-hmm. what standards we set for ourselves, where there's so much the kind of possibility for, you know, people to plant ideas in your head about that the way to be the best surgeon you can be is to approach it in some like altruistic way that doesn't necessarily, you know, that makes you miserable or that makes you burn out, or just to, you know, work 24 hours a day without sleep because that's what the best surgeons mm. do, and you know, or to go to Harvard because Harvard has the best name even if it may not have the training. So there are tons of ways to go wrong.
Yeah.
But I would say, as you know, that in an ongoing way, that self-esteem both is what inspires and kind of pushes you to make the effort and results from a successful process of doing that.
That felt like a complete answer right there.
Yeah.
So one more for you then to wrap this all up would be, if someone is watching this right now and is into some of these ideas or is struggling to put together that complete package, and you had to give them something to just take that initial step, what would that be?
I would say, think about the fact that you only have so many years to live, that this is your life, and think about what you want to make of it, and really spend some time thinking about that. And also think about whether it's the case that that's something, when you do think about it, that you think, yeah, I want that. I want to figure this out. I'm hungry for making my life the best it can be. And yet it's strange to me that in going through my life, I'm not hearing that that's good, that that's what's important, and I'm not hearing advice on how to do it. And I'd like more inspiration along that line. And if the answer to that is yes, I do want that, mm-hmm. then I would say a great thing to do is read The Fountainhead, read Atlas Shrugged, maybe read The Virtue of Selfishness.
Yeah, and just, I guess, to build on that a bit, I would maybe ask myself, when have I felt the most, the cleanest, most honest reverence, whether it was for a person that I admired, whether it was for an idea, whether it was even just for myself acting on principles that mattered to me? Like, can I channel that truth, you know, and that energy and that courage? Because it's a really difficult battle to identify and unearth all of these bad premises that we've swallowed from the culture, and to really genuinely, you know, to take the difficult path that really gives us what we passionately want. And so to kind of, to find the inspiration. And I think reading those books and talking to some of the people who've been on this show is a step, but kind of to really dig deep and figure out, when have we been most honestly inspired?
Thanks for listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. You can also find us on YouTube. If you like this content, please share or leave us a review. For more information, go to AynRand.org.